Over three decades, Lampire Biological Laboratories has been a trusted partner for your drug discovery needs. We offer a variety of services, standard protocols, and full customizations. For your free consultation, please call 215-795-2838 or email lampire@lampire.com.
Hello and welcome to our podcast, Being a Life Sciences Leader, brought to you by Life Sciences Pennsylvania and Troutman Pepper. I'm Chris Molyneux. I'm the president and CEO of Life Sciences Pennsylvania, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this episode of our podcast. I'm joined, as usual, by my co-host, Rachel Bushy. Rachel is the chair of the Health Sciences Department at Troutman Pepper. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me again. We've got a terrific guest this morning, Ron Philip, who is the CEO of Spark Therapeutics. Ron took over that role in April of 2022, but has been with the company since 2017. So we're delighted to have Ron here. Rachel's going to introduce Ron in just a moment, but I wanted to let our audience know that this is a special recording of the podcast because we're in front of a live studio audience at Life Sciences Pennsylvania's annual conference, Life Sciences Future Biopharm. There's more information about Life Sciences Future Biopharm, as well as information about Life Sciences Pennsylvania at our website, which is lifesciencespa.org. That's lifesciencespa.org. So welcome to our podcast. Thank you, Rachel, and I will ask you to introduce our guest.
Well, so first of all, we have Ron Philip here today with us, the CEO of Spark, and we are absolutely delighted and so excited to hear about your story. But before we really kick off with our questions, can you give our listeners a little bit of your background and history and how you came to be CEO?
Sure. First of all, hi, everybody. Ron Philip. I have the privilege of leading a highly talented group of individuals at Spark Therapeutics. I actually immigrated to the U.S. when I was 9 years old, and I've been in Philadelphia pretty much ever since. And so I went to public school here in Philadelphia as well as at Drexel University. So I've been in and around Philadelphia for a very long time. And through the Philadelphia kind of angle, I had the opportunity to work at a lot of life sciences companies just because we're obviously very close proximity to New Jersey and New York and obviously the Pennsylvania company. So I started my career at Merck in White House Station and then left to do some consulting. I was with Deloitte Consulting for about 6 years, and then left Deloitte and joined Wyeth, which was then eventually bought by Pfizer. I spent a combined about 10 years at Wyeth and Pfizer, and then after I left Pfizer, I joined Spark Therapeutics in 2017. So that's kind of the journey in
that's
a nutshell.
Terrific. So tell us about that first job at Merck. And what interested you about the life sciences? Why did you start there, and why did you get into the life sciences along the way?
I skipped a couple of steps before the Merck job. So because I was at Drexel, they have the cooperative education program. So as part of the learning curriculum, you get to do 3 internships, where they're basically 6-month cooperative education opportunities. And the first one was at a company called Celanese, which is now part of Sanofi. And then the last 2 co-ops that I did was at Johnson & Johnson. So I was kind of geared towards pharma very early on, and I just, you know, obviously spent a ton of time in a variety of different departments there, and I enjoyed
that. What attracted you to pharma, though? Was it the science, the commercial interest?
You know, when you immigrate to the country when you're 9 years old, you don't know really, you know, what the choices are.
You got into pharma when you were 9.
So you're kind of figuring things out on the fly, right? And really what Drexel offered me the opportunity was to get practical hands-on experience. I wouldn't say I targeted Celanese in my first co-op. It was just the job that was available. And so I didn't have the network that I could turn to and say, which industry should I really dedicate myself to? What are the things that that you selected? Because it was, you know, as an immigrant, you end up having blue-collar background. You don't have the white-collar set of people or peers to go talk to. And with my parents, it was more like, you know, hey, we figured out how to come to a brand new country. You'll do fine. go do what you need to do. So it was just random luck that it ended up being Celanese, and because I got into that industry, I just focused myself on continuing to stay in that industry because I enjoyed the work and the people and the culture and obviously the mission that's associated with the life sciences companies.
Yeah. And Kenny Szymanski from Drexel's in the audience, and I'm sure he's appreciating all these plugs for Drexel. So
you left Merck around 2017 and joined Spark. What is that right?
Pfizer.
Pfizer and joined Spark. What led you to leave Pfizer and join Spark?
Yeah, I think with Pfizer, I mean, I was in a variety of strategy roles for, starting at the Wyatt days. It was really internal consulting strategy type roles. And then finally, I got the opportunity to go into an operational role, which was in 2013 when I was asked to go to Dubai to lead the Africa Middle East business on behalf of the Pfizer innovative businesses. And so this was my first taste of actually moving from advising to actually doing, right? It's really a neat experience to be able to have a ton of time to develop strategies, to find solutions. But, you know, the person that I was working for at that time, Gina Germano, said, it's very different when you're in the operating chair. You've got about 2 minutes for strategy, and you got the rest of the day for, you know, fighting fires and dealing with all of the operational implications of the strategy that you want to lay out. So he basically said, it might be a good opportunity for you to go learn what that's like. I don't want you to fall in love with operations because I want you to come back and do strategy, but it would be a good experience to have because it'll just make you a better strategist. I did the exact opposite of what he told me to do. I fell in love with operations because it just gives you immediate feedback.
Yeah.
And you know, everybody loves the fact that you're needed to solve problems and all those things, but I think the combination of having that strategic background and actually being able to get hands-on with the operational implementation of a variety of countries with different payer systems and all kinds of, you know, different issues, you just get the dopamine, whatever release that you get from that is hard to describe. And I just, when I came back to strategy at Pfizer, it just wasn't the same. Mm-hmm. And for me, I realized at that time it was time for me to leave and go do something that would give me the combination of strategy and operations experience.
Yeah.
And that's where Spark just made a ton of sense.
Well, you know, the focal point of this podcast is on leadership and leadership traits and hoping to impart some leadership attributes to our audience. Gino Germano was one of the very well-known great leaders at Pfizer and in the industry. What were some of the leadership traits you picked up from him? And it's also interesting to hear from some of our guests, which we have, things they saw from other leaders that they intentionally avoided. So were there things that you adopted from Gino and things that
you avoided? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I give him a ton of credit for the influence that he had on my career overall, just in the experiences that he allowed me to get into. But more than anything else, it was just watching him in action. And it's not just him. I think probably the first lesson that I learned is the team that he built mm-hmm. around himself, right? He put together a very strong, not only strategic, but operational team that really was kind of the who's who, and especially when you think about who's out there now. This is Michael Gottler, who is the CEO of Viatris, Liz Barrett, CEO of Urogen, Paul Levesque, CEO of Theratechnologies, Richard Blackburn.
Great alumni.
The list goes on and on. And the people that didn't go out to become CEOs, they're the heads of businesses at Pfizer, and they're running 15, 16, 20 billion dollar businesses. So I'm sitting there early in my career watching all of these people, including Gino, and you just can't help but learn a ton of stuff from that experience. And so from Gino, what I really learned is focus, right? He is a big proponent of make sure the main thing is the main thing and make sure it's not more than three things, right? And if you get up every morning and you're focused on that main thing and you're focusing on those three things that you want to solve for in any given year or multi-year period, you're going to be successful. And he executed that to perfection. What I learned from the others is risk-taking, entrepreneurship, and a variety of different things. And I learned some other not-so-great traits in terms of...
We're interested in those, too.
Those are interesting.
You know, I think I came into it already knowing it. It's really... When you come from the background that I come from, I didn't speak the language for 5 years when I came here. So you listen a lot. You absorb a lot. Mm-hmm. You don't really participate as much. And so I got used to kind of being just the guy in the room, just absorbing a bunch of information and not getting into politics, whether that was in high school, college. It translated to even when I started a co-op. I saw the politics going around me, but I was aware of it. I knew how to maneuver around it, but I never partook in it. And I still don't do that. I mean, even from my seat, it's a waste of time, to be honest. And it actually prevents people from building the right cultures, you know, being in the job that they want to be in. So I think a lot of the learnings that I took away on mostly the negative things, especially when you're talking about a highly competitive set of people who are your peers, is to avoid all of that, because you stand out if you avoid all of that.
One of the things we always ask our guests is there something along the way that you did that you wish you had done differently or that you learned from? Because I always think that you learn a lot of times more from your mistakes than what we've done well. Is there something in your leadership rise or anything that you looked at and said, well, wow, I tried this, it was a colossal failure, and I learned X?
Yeah, I think it's more than anything else is listen more. You know, I think we all fall into the trap of, hey, we know something and we are right. We have some kind of gut intuition, you know, that's going to absolutely get you to the right answer, right? And I think the biggest learning for me is if you build that team of the people that you want to have around that table, make sure you listen to them, right? They're
and
the
empower
ones.
Empower them.
Yeah, exactly. And you create delegation and empowerment almost immediately when you actually action some of those things. And, you know, I learned a little bit of that in consulting, but I think really when I really realized it was in these last 10 years where you don't really have to be the smartest guy in the room. The collective team that's in that room is way smarter than any individual in that room. And you really want to empower them to give them the platform to speak freely and then obviously utilize that information to make the best decision possible.
And so did you always have your sights set on CEO?
No. Even before the process to become CEO, I wasn't sure whether I wanted to be CEO.
Which probably makes you a great CEO, though.
Yeah, I mean, I've always thought of myself as probably the advisor to the CEO, because that's where I was kind of trained. It was really that consulting background, that strategy background. And I always thought, you know, that's something that I can really do and I like doing. I think the operational turn in AFME when I was at Pfizer really started to change my mindset. And then as things progressed at Spark and the milestones that we were meeting, the increased responsibilities that Jeff was giving me during that time frame, it just gave me more and more confidence to be able to say, you know, I'm ready to do that. And when we were going through the process, I mean, there was other opportunities that I was looking at, and I had to really kind of figure out, you know, what kind of company did I want to go to, right? And Spark had a variety of things that obviously stood out, and that's why I stayed, and I went into the process at Spark.
So can you describe that in the internal environment as a leader? You were chief commercial officer, then chief operating officer, then you all got into the discussions about the acquisition, which went on for a long time. What was the internal environment like, and what did you and Jeff and the other members of the leadership team need to do to maintain focus for the team?
Yeah, it's a great question, Chris. It was a very interesting time, and I'll put the interesting in quotes there. Right? we obviously ended up getting into the merger agreement early on. I mean, obviously before that, we were a startup company, very much focused on the street. What are the strategies that we need to lay out and the operational performance that we needed to show in order to kind of...
Yeah, had to keep doing the work.
Exactly,
yeah.
And you're constantly raising money and doing all those things, right? And so that was a more known thing. I think where it got a little tricky for us is we obviously agreed to being bought, and then the FTC May process in the UK really kind of drug on for a while there, right? And I think in that period, this is where I watched Jeff, you know, it's really courage under fire, right? To have that steady platform to be able to kind of navigate the organization. Obviously, members of the CMT helped him along the journey, but we reacted to how he was feeling and operating. And it was a great example of someone that, you know, just understood that, yes, it's a challenging time, but you have to show optimism and you have to show steadiness, and we as a company was a reflection of that because of the leadership that he showed. And I think as a result of that, we really didn't skip a beat. I mean, it was an awkward time, but we kept on doing the work that we needed to do until the regulatory process is wrapped up. Luckily for us, it was a successful end result, but it could have gone either way. And the good news was for us, we were ready for either direction. If we exited that time frame without having, you know, that successful exit, we would have been ready to continue to operate as a company. And that's really a credit to Jeff and the leadership team that was there at that time.
Excelling in pharma is tougher than ever. Companies often turn to big consulting for help. But are those famous firms truly the most capable, most nimble, most effective partner? Aspirant's Org Accelerator is a better solution. Using our AI-powered assessment tool, along with our industry expertise, we will revamp your team structure to jumpstart collaboration in just 12 weeks. For more on how Org Accelerator can help propel your company's performance, visit us at aspirant.com.
So Spark, the acquisition, was the largest in biotech history in Philadelphia since about 1999, I think. The J&J acquisition of Centocor. So that's a long stretch after many years of the community talking about the need for an anchor tenant in Philadelphia. Spark is now that anchor tenant. You've solidified Silicon Valley and the leadership of cell and gene therapy for Philadelphia. Do you feel any of that external spotlight on either yourself or the team? Which is, it's the environment. It's not even necessarily about your business.
Yeah, I don't think there's any more spotlight. I think we're all internally motivated to get more treatments to patients. So the mission is still the same.
How about any obligation
to
the broader community?
Yeah, I think we do have a Philadelphia focus, for sure, right? And one of the things that, especially with my background of coming to this country, coming to Philadelphia, and seeing the kind of the diverse environment that Philadelphia has, it was, for me, a big help, right? And so to be able to do something in Philadelphia like we have been doing with Spark and to create an environment for more people to get access to medicines as well as jobs that are in the biopharma sector is something that's highly motivating. As you know, we're building a big facility, almost a $700 million gene therapy innovation center at FLOT with Drexel as part of the Drexel campus. And, you know, one of the big motivations...
There's that plug for Drexel.
One of the big motivations for that is the opportunity to do pre-bachelor jobs in that facility and to be able to work with Drexel to come up with some kind of a program that allows for people that don't have to go to a four-year college to be able to get the vocational training to be able to get into those manufacturing jobs. And so we're really excited about what we could do moving forward in terms of giving back to the community that we're in, as well as more broadly within the life sciences sector here in Pennsylvania.
And so Spark is very well known for all of your efforts in that.
Yeah, so that's interesting. You know, one of the things during the acquisition, I think there was a big focus on whether you would still have a commitment to Philadelphia and stay in Philadelphia. And you guys have, obviously, with the building of the manufacturing facility. But was that a big point of negotiation? Has it been an area of focus? Was it just deferential to you guys, or have you been intentional? What, you know?
Yeah, we had those discussions with Roche, but I think they saw very early that the concentration of knowledge and talent in this space for gene therapy, it just made no sense to go somewhere else, you know, to San Francisco or to Boston or anywhere else.
This is where
the talent is, and you want to build the hub in places that have talent, right? And so I think Roche, you know, again, they've been wonderful throughout this entire process. They saw that immediately, and they said, go, you know, and this is the place where you should build, you know, kind of the future, you know, kind of bandwidth for what we want to do overall from genetic medicine. So that's exactly what we're in the process of.
Yeah, and that just reminds me that we were supposed to have this breakfast in this room 2 years ago with Severin Schwan and Jeff Marazzo as our guests talking about that deal. And we ended up having it virtually, obviously, in 2020. But one of the points that they both made was how the two of them clicked culturally,
yep.
organizational culturally? Can you talk about the integration? And
I think it's really the follow the science mentality. Mm-hmm. I think Roche has always done that, and they've done that for 125 years. And that is, they're not big into this, you know, the big commercial kind of thing. They're really focused on getting the best product possible with the most quality data, and let the product kind of speak for itself. And that's exactly kind of our ethos, right? Where, you know, when you bring a gene therapy forward, it's a one-time thing. You've got to make sure that it's got the profile, safety, efficacy, durability, predictability. And we follow that same exact formula, obviously much later, 10 years ago was when we first started. But because of that, we automatically had the same mindset, which is patient first. It's really follow that science element. And then the combination we just made, it was just easy, just because we thought the same way. Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to talk a little bit about your journey from COO to CEO. So did you know, Chris and I were talking about this a little bit before, but did you know that you were basically next in line for the CEO? What was that process like? I know you can't get into everything,
yeah,
obviously, but
yeah,
just give a little bit of an
sure
indication.
Yeah, I think I was the last person to know when I became COO, right? Because everybody kind of told me, I guess you're next in line. I was like, well, I think this is more about just making sure that we get the operations pieces right. Now, it really didn't hit me until the process for when Jeff was deciding to leave, and that kicked off the, you know, kind of the selection process at Roche around who was going to be the next CEO. That's when, you know, everything became real. It's like, first you have to, as I said earlier, figure out whether you want the job. Number two, once you go into the process, you have to be ready for whatever comes out of it. It's kind of a one-way thing. You either get it or you don't, right?
Right.
And so, you know, you have to consult with your family, you have to consult with other people to figure out, you know, what's on the other side of this decision. And so for me, it was a steady progression. I always just focus on my job. I really don't think about my next thing, because I give it, like, I haven't been raised that way. My father always told me, he's like, whatever you do, work harder than everybody else in that room and just focus on getting to the best result possible, and everything else will take care of itself. And that's what I've always done. And for me, the next logical step just comes because of the work that you do. It's not because you're angling for that next step. It's because the product that you produce is what creates the opportunities for the future.
And how would you characterize yourself as a leader? And I'll ask Denise Bradley to come up and
truth check me. Yeah, I think I still follow the same format as when I started, you know, in consulting, which is, consulting is a very short time frame to solve problems, and you got a team of people that usually are much smarter than you. And so that's stayed through the rest of my career as well, especially when you're working with the groups that I work with. And so it's basically back to what I said before. It's give them the space to talk, listen to them, absorb the information. What I actually train myself on the most is to process a lot of information and figure out the data points to make the best decisions possible. So that's what I bring to almost any discussion. I think I do anyway, right? And so what that allows me to do is kind of stay out of it, right? And let other people kind of put those data points together that we can end up using. If they don't do it, and sometimes you have a team that's very reticent to kind of, you know, go off a blank sheet, and they want to obviously get something, I can throw something out there. And I have this great ability to throw out the worst ideas possible and not worry about what that might mean in terms of how they look at me in terms of them beating it up. And so I do that on purpose sometimes.
I was going to say, yeah, you probably encourage that.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I really do. And beat it up, and let's make the best decision together that's possible.
And how do you make that change from your old job to your new job, right? So letting go, we've, you know, heard from some leaders that letting go of COO and the operations and kind of standing back can be difficult. Was that hard for you in the beginning, you know, kind of now being more of the bringing everybody to decision point and less of, you know?
No, I think for me it was because I was in strategy roles, I was always influencing without direct authority. Right, and so it just comes naturally to me, where I don't even think about them being a direct report or not. I'm just trying to talk to Rachel, I'm trying to talk to Chris about this problem or this opportunity, and here's the facts that we know. What do you think? And it doesn't really matter whether we report to each other or not. It's really about getting to the end goal. And so I think people naturally are comfortable, you know, in dealing with me in those kind of circumstances. So even when I was COO, you know, I didn't have the development officer reporting to me. I didn't have the CTO reporting to me. I didn't have the research officer reporting to me. But I had to work with all of them. I was head of the portfolio product strategy committee, and I ran the late stage kind of, you know, process for making sure that we're moving things from, you know, research all the way to phase three. And so even though I didn't have the direct authority, I would be able to work with them and to work on the facts on the table and then decide what's the best course of action. So it wasn't ever uncomfortable moving to this stage because I still operate the exact same way. I don't throw the CEO hat on the table and say, I'm just going to outvote you. That's just never the way I worked.
What's been your biggest challenge?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge is always the same thing. It's you know, we have a platform technology that's still early, and you've got to make a ton of tough decisions in terms of how do you develop the platform technology through the assets that are available. So there is this notion of we're constantly balancing technical risk with disease area risk. And you have to balance that carefully because you don't want to over-index on both, because that's how you get into trouble. And so you always have to pick targets that are a little less, you know, lucrative, a little less profound, because you're really working on the technology side. And what that means is sometimes you have to make some tough calls on the portfolio side where you know your technology is going to work for patients, but you can't afford to do it because you've got the opportunity cost of doing something else, right? And all of those decisions are tortured just because, again, the reason we are all in this industry is to help patients. And whenever those strategic choices are in front of me, I always get that pit in my stomach saying that, what can we do? Maybe we can't do it, but maybe we can go partner with somebody else.
So. Yeah, that's an important message, the pit in the stomach, because that's not unique to Ron Phillip. Today, if you think about the environment that companies are operating in, the financial environment is very difficult. The regulatory environment is always very difficult. But particularly in 2022, the financial markets have been very tough. A lot of money on the sidelines. What advice would you give to a startup CEO as they struggle through the rest of this year?
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably not the best qualified to answer this question, but I've watched,
Put your Deloitte hat back.
Jeff, you know, navigate these things over the years that he's built Spark. I think probably the thing that, from what I gleaned from the early days of Spark, and I think they still hold true, number one is, you know, make sure you've got the right board, right? And the right set of advisors. It doesn't have to be a formal board, but the right set of advisors. And then listen to them, right? A lot of people collect a lot of advice, but they don't actually listen to the advice. You're actually, you know, taking a lot of time from these influential people that have been there and done that. And there's a lot of themes that truly apply. Maybe not all of it, but there are always, you know, kind of pearls of wisdom in the advice that they provide. Obviously, if it's a formal board, it's a much more structured process to be able to do that. I think that's number one. Number two, surround yourself with really good leaders, right? And I think the hardest part about startup CEO is you can't afford to get that, you know, kind of that 10-year leader that's going to be working with you. You might have to go with the 2-year option or the 18-month option just to get through the next catalyst for you to raise money. And I think, you know, in each of those moments, there are people that have the aptitude to develop into something that could be the 10-year. Mm-hmm. The 18-month person could be the 10-year person. And so you really have to do your homework up front to figure out the cultural fit of that team. And if you can get the cultural fit right, anything's possible. People will surprise you, and they'll do wonderful things if you get the culture right. And if you get that fit together in that core team at the beginning, and as you saw with Spark, that core team at the beginning had that camaraderie, that fight, and that grit to be able to overcome, I mean, an enormous set of challenges, right? And really, that's
scientific and business.
Scientific and business, absolutely. And so I think that's really the two pieces of advice. And I think that the rest of it naturally comes because that culture creates the hiring for the next layer and the next layer after that. And if you can keep that together, you've got something powerful. Now, science may not work, you know, investors may not be enthused, but it's not because you didn't do the right things. You set yourself up for success if you do those basic things. Yep.
So that's the point I did want to touch on, which is culture. In a smaller company, it's really easy to shape the culture, right? When you have a smaller team, as you've grown, then you're through acquisition. How much of an ability do you have, or do you think you have, to shape culture? And how would you describe the culture at Spark?
I honestly think it's my number one job, right? It's to not only maintain kind of the startup culture that we had, but also as we scale, trying to get to the other side, which is more of a mid-sized pharma. So we're going, and Denise is helping me with this, is going through the transformation of where we were in the scrappy startup days to now becoming a little bit bigger and a little bit more process heavy and a little bit more governance oriented. But what we want to do is keep the best of the old world, but also embrace kind of the cultural elements that we need for the new world, right? And so we're in the process of doing that, but I think that to me is the thing that that's the main thing for me. If I said it before, keep the main thing the main thing, that is the main thing for me.
That's a great point. So we do have to wrap up here, but one question we do try to ask all of our guests is, what do you wish you knew 10 years ago that you know now?
I think I touched on it earlier. It's just once you collect that group of people, it's the hardest thing to do is listen. It really is. And you have to be disciplined. And you have to kind of put your ego aside. And you have to really look at the background of the individuals that you put together and really spend that time to kind of empower them, to Rachel's point earlier, to give them the authority to kind of bring forward great ideas. And they're all in there, right? But leaders have a way of suppressing that sometimes. And that's where you get into real trouble. And the hero leader days are over, I think. Mm. There are some special people that can do those types of things. I'm not one of those, right? I need that collection of individuals to really provide the advice. And I think I learned that, you know, about 10 years ago, that it's time to make a shift. It's time to take advantage of what you put together.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, thank you, Ron. We've been talking to Ron Phillip, the CEO of Spark Therapeutics. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you.
For your time today. And thank you, as always, Rachel, my co-host. That concludes this podcast. You can listen to our previous podcasts by visiting the Life Sciences Pennsylvania website. That's lifesciencespa.org, lifesciencespa.org. You can also submit comments in the notes pages on the website for ideas about future guests or any feedback you have for the podcast. Thank you for listening. Thank you to our live studio audience here at Life Sciences Future BioPharm. Thank you again to Troutman Pepper for supporting this program. We will see you next time. Thank you.